Before I begin our comments here substantially, let me make two prior comments. First, apologies to Paul Murphy. When I sent my outlines to Jonathan about my three talks, I labeled them session 1, 2, and 3 because I didn't know the schedule. I didn't mean to cut you out as though your sessions didn't count. They do count. I just numbered them this way because I didn't know any better. So I should have asked before I did that. So my apologies, Paul, for doing that. And secondly, on my webpage, I normally keep a relatively current syllabus to my course on Christ and the media. And it has a bibliography that's about 9 pages long and mostly annotated about the authors who have informed my opinions about these matters. So if 3 or 4 of you take an interest, just go to tdgordon.net, just my initials and last name, all lowercase, tdgordon.net, and you'll find a media tab on there, and it will take you to the place where I keep a fairly recent syllabus. If you're interested, if I mention someone and you say, I'd like to know what that is, you can go find the bibliography there. That way I don't have to burden you with too much bibliography as we speak, and so feel free to go there. So today we're talking in our first session, it's a general introduction to media ecology, and you note that, you see I put that in quotation marks. It's a very unappetizing term, isn't it? Right? Normally, if someone says, what do you teach? I'll say, well, I teach a little biblical studies and some Greek and so forth. But if I say, I also teach a course in media ecology, their eyes roll back and go, oh, don't let that little man explain it, right? You can just see what's more unappetizing than media ecology. But Neil Postman says he got it from Marshall McLuhan, under whom he studied in Toronto. And it's actually kind of a useful thing. So let me say something about the term itself. You and I know that ecology is not just the study of environments. It's the study of how the environment is amenable to some forms of life and not amenable to others, right? So ecologists do not study merely environments, but the kinds of life that are encouraged by some environments more than others. And so arid plants that grow in Arizona would not grow in the western Pennsylvania forests where I hang my hammock these days, right? And vice versa. The ferns that are all over our forests in western Pennsylvania because the deer won't eat them, you don't see ferns in the high desert of Arizona. So ecologies and environments are not studied for their own sake. They're also studied for the sake of what forms of life find those to be flourishing environments versus the others. So among the human ecologies are the media by which we know one another. So remember that a medium is anything that's in medias. It's anything that's between something. So Edward Case, I understand, was a medium between the living and the dead, right? He was a go-between, a bridge between the living and the dead. Now, personally, I think that's a lot of hooey, and I'm not sure he was very successful at it. But he called himself a medium, didn't he? Because he at least professed to mediate between the living and the dead. And so media ecology says for communicative beings, for beings that commune with and communicate with one another, how we do so is terribly important to us. And the study of that important reality is called media ecology. It's a very unappetizing term to me, but it's a very fascinating matter. So as Jonathan and I were chatting about it, you know, I said that as the image of God, we are the image of a triune God. And the Trinity was a tricky thing. Those reared, as the apostles were, in a Jewish monotheistic environment that distinguished itself from the polytheism of the Greco-Roman world, it was a very dangerous thing to start talking about a tri-personal deity because it sounded so much like polytheism. It was a risky, risky thing. But the only God that we know is the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, whose Son at Pentecost sent in some unusual measure his Spirit to dwell in our hearts forever. So the only God we know is God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, ever living in blessed intercommunion and communication. And so part of the image of God in us is that we share what is in our heart and mind with others and try to get what's in our heart and mind into the heart and mind of others. That's what it is to be human. And so how we do that and why we do that and how doing it shapes us is to me one of the most important of all of life's questions. Think about the Holy Scriptures, 66 canonical books with a lot of words in them and not one picture, right? Not one picture. What's worse, one of the commandments says you shall not make any likeness of anything in heaven above, earth beneath, waters beneath the earth. So God was the first media ecologist. You cannot convey the true and living God through an image. You have to make something else to be that image. The human is made in God's image. Because despite our faults, we could be merciful, and an inanimate thing can't. We could be just, we aren't always. An inanimate thing cannot be just. We could be compassionate. We aren't always, but an inanimate thing cannot be compassionate. And so God really risks, even in the created order, to make something in his image at all. But when he did so, he made a vital living thing his image and prohibited that vital living thing from letting anything else be a substitute for it, and especially a visual thing, because God, outside of his incarnation, is also not material and not visual in that sense. So God is very, very sensitive to media, and he tells us which ones we may use and which ones we may not. So cultural anthropologists study human tool-making. Isn't it fascinating what they do? They have an archaeologist out somewhere, and he finds stuff from the Bronze Age or the Iron Age or something, and they pull up enough to fit in the, like, three shoeboxes, and they can tell you all about a civilization from three shoeboxes, right? And all I can tell you is there must have been females there if it was shoeboxes. That's all I know about it. But if they find the tools that a culture uses, they can tell you all about the culture. So if they find an axe, if they find a plow, if they find a shovel, right, they can tell you all about the culture. And cultural anthropologists, therefore, have always said that we make tools, and tools make us. There's a reciprocity between us and our tools, that we make them, and they in turn make us. I was adding a room to our house in Massachusetts shortly after we moved there in the early 1980s. And after adding the room, I was building a deck on the back. And so I was trying to figure how to make the deck square. I wanted it 10 by 14, but I didn't want a trapezoid, especially with a deck, right? I wanted it square. And so I had 14 feet against the house and put the plate there against there, a 2 by 10, I suppose. And then I had 10-foot pieces of string coming out and a 14-footer in between. I was trying to figure, where do I put these? So I know where to put the sonotubes in the ground and put the concrete and make my footers. And, of course, I suddenly remembered geometry from high school, right? And A squared plus B squared equals C squared. I didn't care what the absolute number, but I knew that when the diagonal, when I put those posts in temporarily, when the diagonal was the same, it was square. And then I could dig my holes and put a sonotube in and pour some concrete. So my wife comes out as she sees me there with a shovel digging away once I figured out where to put the holes. She says, "What are you making?" And I said, "Calluses." Right? We make tools, and tools make us. Right? When we use a tool, it always does something to us. We are different than we were before. And so a young man in Paris today, 10 years old, is speaking French. And a young man 10 years old in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania today is speaking something approximating English. Right? But neither of them chose it. They come into a world where either French or English is spoken, and that shapes them profoundly. Right? One, by the time he's in junior high school, will be able to read Marcel Proust. And the other will be able to read Shakespeare, each in their own languages, right? And so the literature that will shape the one's life is very different than the literature that shapes the other's life. And they didn't choose this. They just came into a world, and I suppose a young German boy is reading Goethe, right? So each of them is reading a literature written in his own native language, and they didn't make any of those choices, and they're shaped profoundly by it, aren't they? Wouldn't it be wonderful to read Tolstoy in Russian? He's wonderful in English translation. But what would it be like to read Tolstoy in Russian? I don't know. I don't know any Slavic languages. I can only imagine it would be really remarkable. So media ecology is studying this reciprocity. What tools do we make, not to dig holes in the ground, but to convey ourselves to one another? And how does the use of those tools shape us? I used to play the airport game when I was in the airport, different than Jonathan's How to Avoid Little People. But I used to play a different game in the airport, and back before we had smartphones, right, when humans talked with one another in the airport, right? It was, I know that seems odd, but it was actually true at one point. And it was very fun to just to meet total strangers while waiting for a flight or on the taxiing on the runway and chat with someone and learn a little bit about people. It's very pleasant. Nowadays, everyone's doing this. It looks like chicken. They're in the farmyard going like this. And I used to play the airport game. After chatting with a person for 15 minutes or so, I'd say, "What have you been reading recently?" And the person would look at me and says, "Well, I haven't mentioned reading. How do you know that I read?" And I would say, "Well, your language is fairly free of colloquialism. It's a more standard, conventional English that has been developed over many years. It's not the, you didn't say awesome every other word, for instance, right?" And they looked at me like I was a magician or something. And sometimes if we talked a little bit longer, 30 minutes in the conversation, I would say, "Do you write professionally or do you just journal because you enjoy it?" And then the person would look, "I didn't mention that I write. How do you know I write?" And I said, "Well, people who write think a little carefully about their communication. So even when they speak, it spills over." You know, Bacon said this, you know, that reading maketh a full man, writing an exact man. Writing an exact man. So I said, you can kind of tell if a person writes, whether just in their journal or professionally, they're very, very precise. And then on two occasions, this is really crazy, on two occasions as I played the airport game and it went even further, the person now squirming away from me, you know, trying to sit some, I want to sit by the big guy, they said, right? I would say to the person, was it Greek or Latin that you studied when you were in school? And the person looked at me and said, excuse my French, those damn nuns made me take 5 years of Latin. How did you know? Right? I said, well, people who have studied an inflected language are never confused by the conjunction and. If it's a compound subject, it's still two nominative pronouns in the nominative case. And if it's the direct object, regardless of the and, it's still two accusative cases. They never mess up whether it's me and her or she and I. Right? You can tell if a person has studied Latin or Greek. So the reason you could play the language game is you could tell what media people used by the way they conveyed themselves. Oral people are different than reading people, and reading people are different than writing people. It's just the way things are. We make tools, and tools make us. It's just the way things are. So that's what we study with media ecology. All media have biases. That is to say, they do some things better than others, right? An axe is different than a saw. And I take both into the woods when I'm out in the woods in western Pennsylvania, a small axe and a small saw. Each does a different thing. And if you're making firewood, they do different things differently. All media do some things better than they do other things. And to use them well is to understand that. They encourage some things. You can say some things in one tool more efficiently than you can in another tool. And so if you look at the history of media, we do this to help you realize the development of media takes a long time in the human race. And each of the media that have been employed by some aspects of humanity have their own biases. They just do some things better than others. You know, some of you, like me, you've lived long enough that you've spent a little time around a graveyard, right? Probably more of my loved ones are gone now than are living, right? And you know that when you're at a funeral, sometimes you stand up to someone afterwards when the graveside service is over. Maybe it's someone you know at work and they've lost a wife or a husband. And sometimes you don't say anything. You just stand beside them and you put your hand on their shoulder, don't you? Right? And sometimes just the human touch of a hand on a shoulder is more important than anything you can say. Right? So sometimes we don't know what to say, but we intuitively think, this person feels alone because grief makes people feel alone. And so maybe the best thing I can do is just physically touch them, right? That's a media ecological decision. And if I'm not mistaken, in this case, it's the right decision. Right? Sometimes that's just simply the best thing to do. When our daughter died of leukemia, our first daughter, many people didn't know what to say. We were young, a young couple. She only lived 14 weeks. We became parents and then non-parents in 14 weeks. And everyone was thinking, what do you say? What do you say? Because no one knows what to say at a time like that. But many people just gripped a shoulder or hugged us, right? And Stephen Mott, a colleague at Gordon Conwell, just wrote a very brief card to us, the worst of all cards. There was nothing in it. So when you don't know what to say, you want to have Hallmark tell you what to say. But Stephen, knowing that I was trained in biblical studies, just wrote, "Dear David, a bruised reed he will not break. Yours, Stephen." That was plenty, wasn't it? It was plenty. And it was a media ecological decision to choose an empty card and then to say those brief things. And that was, Marion died in 1986. I still remember it, right? Very, very memorable that he wrote those few brief, memorable things at that point. So we are constantly making these decisions. Whether we've studied media ecology or not, we are constantly making decisions about how we commune with one another. So let me just say before we go through these various eras, is that my friend Greg Reynolds, some of you know him because Greg edits The Ordained Servant for the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Greg always reminds us that both in Latin and in English, there is a relationship between communion and communication. They have in common the word common, right? And the highest forms of communication is when we convey ourselves to one another, which we call communion. And communication is the more sterile term, the more arid term, for when we just communicate information, a crazy lecture, right? I've communed more with you by telling you about our daughter than anything on this outline, and she's not even on the outline, right? I conveyed myself to you, a father who still weeps over his daughter and does not apologize for it 33 years later. Because I will not apologize for loving my daughter, right? I've communed more than I've communicated, and that's okay, because that's what we do. We share ourselves with one another. That's life. The Father shares life with the Son and the Holy Spirit forever, and they are it's a communing Godhead, and we are communing people made in the image of that God. That's what we do. So if we look then briefly at this history, media ecologists say there are five or six moments or eras in media ecology. They don't disagree, and they don't fight when I say 5/6. There's no argument. It's just, if you look at my number four, you'll see that two important eras happen at the same time. The telegraph and the photograph are developed within about 4 years of each other in the 1840s. So do we call that one moment, because by the calendar it is one moment, or do we call it two moments because the consequences are momentous, right? So there's no real difference. We just don't know how to number it. And so there are these either five or six moments in the history of human mediation. The most basic, of course, of all human media is orality. Some cultures have no other way of conveying information or knowledge other than they speak to one another. Now, most of them now don't exist. There are very small cultures that are still oral. There are some of them down in Papua New Guinea. They still have some oral cultures that cultural anthropologists study. But for the most part now, most people living on the planet speak a language that is also written. But the most basic form of human communion is language. It's fundamental to us. And that's the most natural form of language. But even it is a medium, remember, because French is different than English, right? Neither French nor English falls off a tree. They are human constructs. And each language, if it's a living language, continues to grow and evolve, because if it doesn't do something we want it to do, we make it do it. And we coin new terms, and we find different ways of making it work for us so that it will carry the freight we want it to carry. So even oral languages are human constructs. That's why each one differs from the other. They are things that we make, and we make them do what we want them to do. So all cultures are oral. And oral cultures, you notice, are biased towards proximity, what is close. They are biased towards community, and they are biased towards memory. So word about that. if you think of a seesaw, one side down, the other side up, that distance and proximity are related that way, aren't they? And some media are biased towards what is different, the electronic media, the telegraph. A person in Boston can send a telegraph message to someone in Texas. You can't shout to someone in Texas. So oral cultures are biased towards proximity, what is within shouting distance, literally. And so oral cultures are cultures, therefore, that are also fairly communal, right? Everything that we know in an oral culture, we know from whom we learned it. Whether it was the village sage or the village idiot. Wasn't this the thesis of Paul Johnson's book, Intellectuals? As he takes a handful of people since the 18th century who've influenced the West, I think he starts with Rousseau, a horrible miscreant, and says, here's these people who shaped us so profoundly, and no one who knew them liked them at all. They were terrible human beings. And he says, only the printing press made these people influential, because people who didn't know them might be persuaded by what they said. But no one who knew them gave them a time of day, because they were horrible. He mentions the playwright Ibsen, and he mentions Rousseau, and so forth, goes through a whole bunch of very influential people that were horrible human beings. Rousseau abandoned his wife and his children and then taught us love of humanity. How can a person teach us love of humanity after abandoning his wife and his children? Right? We wouldn't listen to such a person if he were around us. So one of the great things about the oral culture is you know what is said and who said it. They are communal cultures. That's just how they are. And it's biased towards memory. Oral cultures had huge memories. The primary intellectual task in an oral culture is memory, because you couldn't write anything down. So oral cultures are always trying to figure out not only what someone is saying, but whether it's worth retaining, and if so, how to make it memorable. It's like my students cramming for a quiz, and they come up with all these mnemonic devices to help them remember what I might ask them on a quiz, right? Jake did it. Liz did it. They all did it when they were at Grove City College. That's just what they do, right? And then they forget it right after the quiz is over. Not these two, but all the rest would forget it right after the quiz ended. They would forget it all. And so oral cultures were incredible, memorizing cultures. They were just profound, because you couldn't write anything down. Paul, I don't know how a middle-aged person survived in those days, right? Because if we don't write it down, we don't remember what we had for breakfast, right? So, those cultures, they probably did remember what they had for breakfast because they had great memories. So their medium of orality did that. Now, you notice the second moment is chirography. The reason we call it chirography, that's just Greek. Chair in Greek, and it was hand, chair, and grapho is right. We could call it in Latin manuscript, hand, writing. You say, well, why don't they just call it handwriting? I say, well, they make more money if they call it chirography, right? But the other reason is this. When you write in an ancient culture, it's not like writing on a nice piece of fine paper with a fountain pen with a gold nib. It's a very different kind of a thing. When you're writing in an ancient culture, you're etching the letters into animal skin. And so it's a very laborious task. It's somewhere between what we call writing and what we call sculpting, right? Almost like someone who etches stuff onto a tombstone. So in an ancient culture, you don't write the superficial. Some goat dies every time you write something, right? Because you're writing on animal skin. And the goat lobby doesn't want you to write down, you know, brief mnemonic devices, right? So in ancient cultures, everything they write is consequential. That's why I think 61 times in the New Testament you see the little formula gagraptai, it is written, right? And your ears and my ears hear that as a theological statement. But as a media ecologist, I hear it as a media ecological statement. What is about to be said is so important that some goat died for it, right? It is written. Some culture decided this was, so when the ancient Jews passed on Torah and the prophets and the Psalms, it's because they regarded them as important, and so they actually wrote them down, right? They're very, very consequential. So chirography or manuscript is a different thing than handwriting, because handwriting is fairly quick, and etching into animal skin is not. So it's probably better to call it manuscript or chirography, lest we think it's analogous to our handwriting. It's a different kind of a thing. It took a long time to develop writing, about a half a millennium. It took about 500 years to convert what is auditory to what is visual. Remember, the medieval world wanted to turn lead into gold in alchemy? They thought, this is great. If we can turn lead into gold, we'll be wealthy. Not realizing that, of course, if you could turn lead to gold, gold would be useless after that, right? It's just as useful as lead at that point. you would completely deflate the value of gold if lead became gold then. But nevertheless, they tried. But imagine turning what is something that we hear from our mother's lap into something we can read with our eyes. It's a magnificent trick if you can pull it off. And it took 5 centuries. I won't bore you about the stages it went through to get there. But by the time you get to Moses in the mid-second millennium B.C., people are writing. But even then, they didn't have vowels. Moses didn't have an alphabet. He had a bet. Right? He didn't have an alpha beta. He had a beta. He only had consonants. The Hebrew Bible is written without vowels. Those were added much later. Over 2,000 years later, the Masoretes added the vowel pointing that we see. And yet, it was still a way of preserving what is auditory in writing. It was a great breakthrough. And so writing cultures are amazing. They have different biases than oral cultures. It's very, very expensive, but it's permanent. One of the things that a writing culture permits is communion with the dead. It's its own form of Edward Case, isn't it? You and I can read Shakespeare. We never met him. We can read Tolstoy. We never met him. On March 4th, I always go back and read the second inaugural address, which I think was Lincoln's finest public speech, and I think it was America's finest public speech. If I could vandalize the Lincoln Memorial, I'd go in with a crane and I'd lift Mr. Lincoln off the pedestal some night, and I would turn the pedestal around and I'd put the Gettysburg Address on the back and the second inaugural address on the front, because right now it's the other way around. You have to go around behind Mr. Lincoln to see the second inaugural. It's on the back. But it's a magnificent, magnificent speech. And I treat myself at least once a year on March 4th to go back and read that marvelous second inaugural address. I never met Mr. Lincoln, right? Never met him. But I have that wonderful address of his that I can ponder and think about whenever I want to. So some of you remember, some of you I see like me are not 30 anymore, but 31 and counting. You remember the debate in the universities in the 90s was what they call the canon wars, not canon with two N's, but canon with one. And they were saying, we're tired of reading books by dead white males. Yeah, right? That was the term of contempt, dead white males. And this curriculum, where we keep reading the so-called great books written by dead white males, right? We should get rid of it. And I said, I don't know what the big deal is. I said, you know, I'm an Augustinian, and he was an African, so I'm not so sure he was that white. And I love to read Augustine, right? And I love the poetry of Emily Dickinson, and especially I love the poetry of Jane Kenyon, who just died in 1995 in New Hampshire. I love Jane Kenyon's poetry. As far as I can tell, she's not a male. She was married to Donald Hall. He was a male, but she wasn't, right? So I said, but I do. So I don't care if my authors are white, and I don't care if they're males, but I do want them good and dead. I want them good and dead, right? Because I know what my contemporaries think. I am one. The only insight I can have on my moment is to talk to someone who doesn't live in my moment. So either H.G. Wells takes me to the future or a book takes me to the past. And that's the only way I can get some insight on my present moment. And so I want many of my authors to be good and dead, right? That's what I want. So one of the things that the writing culture does, the oral culture couldn't, it allows us to commune with those who went before us. And to have conversation with them. At least we can listen to them. So that's why writing is such a wonderful thing. But remember that in a handwriting culture before the printing press, only about 2 to 3% of any population was literate. There'd be no reason to read if you didn't have a book. And before the printing press, when everything is etched into animal skin by hand, it's terribly expensive. And so writing was a rarity. The reason the scientific revolution took place when it did, 150 years after the printing press, is because of the printing press. You have the wide dissemination of knowledge that the printing press fostered. So that's our third great moment, is the moment of typography, when you can mass produce written stuff. And they say that within about 125 years of the development of the printing press, 80% of Europe was now literate. You go from 3% literacy to 80% literacy in a little over a century. Right? The human becomes the reading human. And so reading became a commonplace within a century, so that people could read Holy Scripture, and later we could read Shakespeare and so forth, this sort of a thing. It's a remarkable thing. And so the printing press is biased towards rationality more than memory. In an oral culture, you have to try to find a mnemonic device to remember things. But in a written culture, you say, well, unless the paper is made out of poor acidic paper, my copy of Shakespeare's sonnets will be here next year. And I can go back and reread sonnet number 29 whenever I want to. And so we don't memorize the sonnets like people once did, because we can just go back and read them. But what reading does, it promotes rationality, because I can read a book, and the person says in the preface or introduction what he's going to write about, and I get to chapter 3 and I say, huh, I think he's changed his definition on me here. I think he meant a different thing earlier. And so I put my devious finger right there in there, and a little bookmark in there, and I go back and I go, he did. He pulled a fast one, right? He said he's writing about this. So what happens is a book printed in pages promotes rationality, because you can interact with the person. Orality comes at you dynamically, and then it's gone. Sound only exists while it's happening. When it stops, it disappears. But a written thing stays there, and it invites you to go back and read and reread and think about it. And so it promotes an extraordinary kind of rationality. And now the primary thing we do with our noodles is we think about things. But in an oral culture, the primary thing we do with our noodle is remember things. So they promote different uses of the human brain. And oral cultures have incredible memories, and writing cultures are a tad more rational. We'll talk later this weekend about what happens when a writing culture becomes illiterate, but at least for the period from 1450 to 1950, we became, in some senses, capable of greater and greater reasoning because we read. You know, when you're doing the airport game in 1950, you can be seated by someone and say, is Mending Wall by Robert Frost a monologue or a dialogue? And the person would say, well, it's a dialogue. There's a person on each side of the stone wall talking with each other as they rebuild a thing. And I said, which is the opinion of the speaker of the poem, right? That good fences make good neighbors? The line is repeated. Or is it that something there is that doesn't love a wall? The other repeated line, which is Frost's opinion and why, right? You can discuss that in a printing press culture because there's kind of common knowledge about certain things. And then you can discuss the meaning of it. I suggested in chapel this week that Psalm 51 is not David's sin as a human. It's not like normal human sin. You and I are not guilty of blood guiltiness. He was, right? Certain things in that thing don't fit. Against thee only have I sinned? What about Uriah, the Hittite? What about Bathsheba? What about the child who later dies as God's judgment? Thee only, right? That doesn't work, right, does it? So it's more likely that it's David's sin as monarch. Who else could send someone to the front lines to run before the chariots, right? But even better, I think it's Israel confessing her sin and asking for a king in the first place, 1 Samuel 8, right? And these will be the ways of the king. He will take your sons and make them run before the chariots. He will take your daughters and make them perfumers and so forth, right? It's David. And in that day you will cry out to me because of your king. I think Psalm 51 is Israel crying out to God, this is the kind of person we got when we wanted to be governed like the other nations were governed, right? Now, I may be wrong, but the point is we can have this conversation, you see, in a printing press culture. We know Psalm 51. It's our common literary heritage, and now we can talk about what it means, right? So that's what printing press does for us. It's a remarkable thing. Then you'll notice 400 years after the printing press, two things happen at the same time, photography and telegraphy, the first electronic medium and the first photographic medium. So no one had a picture in their house prior to the 19th century unless they were royalty. You had to be really wealthy to hire some portrait artist to paint a painting. And so our homes would be more likely to have macrame on the walls or some stitching of a little poem or something than to have a photograph. Right. By the way, the medical people, medical historians say there were no eating disorders prior to the photograph. None. They didn't exist. Because the humans we knew were just the humans we knew. There were some tall ones, the Dutch. There were some short ones, the non-Dutch, right? You know, there were some broader ones that you didn't want to sit beside on the airplane, and then there were God's chosen that everyone wants to sit beside on the airplane, right, because they take up less space. But we just accepted the fact that people were shaped differently. But then with the photograph, people can keep pummeling us with this after this after this after this and convince us that that's the way a human should look, and I don't look like that. So eating disorders are the direct medical result of photography. There are no eating disorders in non-photographic cultures. Isn't that fascinating, right? It's a very fascinating reality. So both of these happen at the same time, and they change everything. So what electronic media do is they alter forever the relationship of the proximate and the distant. Because beginning with the telegraph, a businessman in Boston could send an immediate message to a businessman in Texas, right? And then, of course, with telephone and then smartphones and so forth, the proximate becomes distant and the distant becomes proximate. And my students now between classes, very different since you two were there. Gene Twinge says the difference is between those born before 1988 and those born after 1995. She says there's a whole generation difference in that seven-year period between those born before 1988 and those born after 1995, and it's because of the smartphone. So when I'm now heading towards my classroom and students are waiting in the hall, clustered, waiting for the other class to get out, and they're all doing this. They're chickening, right? And so sometimes I just have to stop the class and I say, young men, these are some of the prettiest young ladies God ever made. They've all come, as Liz did, to Grove City College. And you're looking at a piece of plastic, right? Now to the young ladies, I say, these guys are duds. Look at your plastic. It's a different story there. But, I mean, why is a college student surrounded by other Christian young people texting someone who isn't present? It's just crazy, isn't it? Because the electric world connects us to those who are distant and makes it distant from those who are close. So inevitably, once or twice a semester, as I'm heading down the hallway, I see a football-sized person coming my way, right? Like Alicia's dad back there, a good-sized guy, and he's coming at me, a 22-year-old boy carrying about 270 pounds, and he's doing this. And he moves towards me with the gait of a speed skater, right? He wobbles this way, and then he wobbles back, and I'm trying to time it so I can zig while he's zagging. Right, because I can tell in a head-on collision who's going to win and who's going to lose, right? And so I see him coming, and I'm trying to time it right now. I always time it wrong, and he bumps into me. And then he looks down at me, right? And I look up at him, and I say, the proper thing to say at this point is, excuse me, right? Right. I would have been so embarrassed just to run into one of my professors, right? We were trained to notice the physical presence of a human incarnate in the same humanity that our Savior came to earth in. When my grandfather was 92, just before he died, and for the last couple of years needed a cane to get around, if he was seated on a couch in a room and a woman entered the room, Pop leaned forward on his cane and stood up to acknowledge her presence, and he wouldn't sit down until she had taken a seat. Right? Because he was reared to notice the presence of the image of God. And now we pay no attention to it at all. We bump into it, right? It's just incredible how the distant has become proximate and the proximate has become distant. My students now, it's kind of funny, I don't know if it happened to you too. When the phone rings, if a student's in my office and my phone rings, I just let it ring, you know. And after the third or fourth ring, it makes the students nervous and say, Dr. Gordon, your phone's ringing. they apparently think I'm either deaf or daft or both, and so they remind me that the phone is ringing, and I say, yeah, my ears still work a little, and I can hear that it's ringing, but you are here right now, and I want to hear what you have to say. And then when you've left, I'll check my answering machine and see if there's an important message. They're surprised that I prefer them to my machine, right? They just assume that I should stop talking with them and give attention to this piece of plastic. So actually, I just plugged my phone back in about 3 weeks ago. It was unplugged since last April. I went for 9 months without it, decided I don't really need it, right? They can bump our voice messages to our laptops, so I can check them that way. And they didn't interrupt me at all for 9 months. And I thought, that's fine. Just deal with the people who were there. They used to say this in the 60s, love the one you're with. It wasn't the most edifying statement, but there was an element of truth to it, wasn't it? If you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with. The first part of that I'm not so sure I liked, but loving the one you're with, there's something to be said for that. Other media are not biased towards distance the way the electronic ones. And, of course, photography changes us from rational, language-based humans to passionate humans. Because, you know, you can't argue with an image. It doesn't make a propositional statement. You can argue with a propositional statement. Was Plato's Republic right or was it wrong? But you can't argue with an image. It is fundamentally non-rational. It goes straight to pathos and it evades logos, to use Greek language, right? So it is not rational. It's irrational. It's passionate. It goes straight to your feelings without assuming the burden of argumentation or reasoning or evidence. And it's the one medium that God in his holy word expressly prohibits us from using religiously. So religious people, especially like Jacques Ellul, don't take lightly when the printing culture, the language culture, becomes an image culture. So his last book that was translated into English was called The Humiliation of the Word. And it's his discourse about the 20th century, the humiliation of the word, because cultures became more and more literate until roughly 1950, and then they started to taper off, and literacy rates have fallen. We'll talk more about that later. They've been falling since then, because we give more of our conscious attention to images than ever before and less to language than ever before. And then the digital culture, what the digital culture does is it combines electric and photographic, right? And so the digital culture has both the virtues and vices of the electronic era and the virtues and vices of the photographic era. And what's worse, we carry them with us. Now, I gave one of my daughters my iPhone 6 last year. I said, if neither of you want it, I'll take it to the range and put a .45 caliber hole in it. And then I went to Verizon and I said, give me the dumbest phone you've got. And she said, well, sir, some of them are less full-featured than others. And I said, you can call it less full-featured and I'll call it dumb, but give me the dumbest phone you have, right? And so I got the dumbest phone possible. But what the smartphone does is it combines the worst of the television and the worst of the telephone, and it goes with you everywhere. At least when I was a child, the telephone was mercifully tethered to a wall somewhere, and you could escape it, right? And the television was tethered to a wall somewhere, and you could escape it. You can't even imagine what happens to me when I'm hiking in New Hampshire now, and I'm in the beautiful White Mountains of New Hampshire, and I see someone coming down the trail looking at a smartphone. And I thought, there's Mount Lafayette right there. It's magnificent. What are you doing looking at a smartphone, right? And so they now disrupt us, right? They go everywhere with us. So the digital world, like the poor, is with us always, right? It leaves us no respite. It constantly demands our attention and distracts our attention from other sorts of things. So as you know, there's an enormous amount of literature now on the digital world and the effect it has on it. I mentioned Gene Twenge earlier. It's T-W-E-N-G-E, not Twenge like T-W-I, but T-W-E-N-G-E. She's at San Diego State University in California. She's written a book called iGen, like iPhone, iGen. And she's done the study using the general social survey of the difference between people born before 1988 and those born after 1995. And it's catastrophic. Young people today, teenagers, are safer than they've ever been. They are statistically less likely to suffer violence than any young people since we've been keeping records of it. But they are the most likely to injure themselves. They're the most fearful of any since we've been keeping records of it. And yet they have less reason to fear than ever before. Because the reality that's mediated to them is not the reality that's around them. They live in a faux world, a false world, a world that's not the real world. And so they maladjust to the real world because they're constantly distracted by a faux world. So as we'll see in some of our other talks, these various media do not merely convey different information. They shape us differently. The reason our ears hear English so well is they've been exposed to it so many years. Had we been in France, we would have had French ears, right? So the neurology is constantly changing. The human neurology always adjusts to what it needs to adjust to. And so the media that we use shape our perceptive faculties. There's nothing we can do to prevent it from doing that. So now you see, this is the disturbing reality of media ecology. What we give our attention to today will shape what we are able to notice tomorrow. And so tomorrow we may run into a little Greek professor in the hallway, or tomorrow we may listen to Schumann. But part of what, whether we do the one or the other, is dictated by what we do today. If we want to have better musical pitch so that we can tell whether the piano is in tune or not, we listen, right? We develop the sound. There's a concert 448, we say. And so the ability to sing on pitch doesn't happen overnight. It comes from years of growing up in the church and having the piano properly tuned and these kinds of things and so forth. We learn all these things. We shape those. So we shape our media, and they do shape us. And that's why you will join me tonight in being an insomniac. The reason I'm an insomniac is my dad was. The reason you will become an insomniac is if you start thinking the way a media ecologist does, you won't be able to sleep well at night. Because you'll be disturbed about things. So, I'm very happy to disturb you to the glory of God. And now Paul will say something intelligent here in a few moments.